Try that. Is that better?
Okay. Send him home, folks. He is. All righty then. I get the golden ticket. Yes. Sir. We are in our John series. We've been going through the book of John. We're in John chapter 3. We're going to continue that today. If you don't have one, we have these study sheets. This is going to follow what we talk about today. And I'd really encourage you to grab one. John or Greg or somebody, could you go get some? And if you want one, raise your hand. One of you two guys want to go? Greg's gone. So if you want one, raise your hand. Greg will give one to you. It's helpful to just to follow along. And we're going to be going through John for quite a while. And so I think it's helpful, too, sometimes to go back and to just kind of look at what we talked about before. And it's also, I would just encourage us to be willing to be students of the Word. You know, we're students of different things. When you're in school, you're a student of whatever you're studying. If you went to college, you were a student of something. All of us study something. Sometimes we study, baseball stats, or we study something. We fix our attention on things. And that's just, God made us that way. He made us with this desire to learn and to know and to understand things. Some things that we study are more important than others, or more helpful than others. You know, sometimes we study things and it's just fun and it's just no big deal. Sometimes we study things and it's really, really helpful or useful to us. When we read the Bible and when we study the Bible, it is God speaking to us. It is what God wrote, and it's foundationally what he wants us to know. You need one here? Up front here. Greg, right here. This is foundationally what God wants us to know. God speaks to us in all kinds of ways, but he starts here. He starts here. And I believe that if you don't have a good understanding of this, God is always going to be a mystery to you. He's always going to be distant. His voice will be unintelligible to you. This is where it starts. I study this. I read it. I study it. Only because I believe and know and have seen how good it is. How much it shapes my emotions. How much it shapes my actions. How much it draws me into God's presence. Man, I would study this if I were you. I would study this if I were you. And so this is just a way to do it. It's just a tool to help you do it. So that's what we're doing. So we are in today, John chapter 3. We've been working through this kind of slowly. We're at toward the end of John chapter 3. We're not quite to the end yet. But we're going to walk through John 3, 22 through 30. And I titled this, What's So Great About John? What's So Great About John the Baptist? John the Baptist is a character that you know, even if you haven't read much of the Bible, you've probably heard of John the Baptist, a very, very big part of the Gospels, those first four books of the New Testament. John the Baptist, really big part of Jesus' early ministry life. We just see a lot about John early on in the Gospels. We see, we're given a picture of, even before he's born, God is speaking to John's parents about what John's going to be. We see John being born. We learn a lot, and we see John interacting with the world around him. We see John interacting with Jesus. John the Baptist is a big, big part of Jesus' life, of the Gospels early on. And again, today, we see that. What we're going to read today, John the Baptist is probably the central figure in this section that we're going to look at today. But it's interesting, after today, John kind of disappears. In the book of John, we only see John the Baptist mentioned two more times, and it's almost in passing. Jesus mentions him in chapter 5 and again in chapter 10, but it's just almost in passing. John the Baptist, this guy that is such a big part of what's been going on up to now, and in the other Gospels as well, disappears from the scene, and we just don't hear about him again. And yet, this is the guy that Jesus said this about. He said this, this shows up in several different Gospels, but in Luke chapter 7, verse 28, this is Jesus speaking about John. I tell you, among those born of women, there is no one greater than John. Among those born of women, there is no one greater than John. That's a big thing. That is high praise coming from Jesus himself. No one greater than John. He goes on to say, yet the one who is least in the kingdom of heaven, one who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. And yet, that's high, high, high praise, isn't it? Basically, on this earth, of those born of women, kind of for all time, there's the gold standard right there. There's no one greater than John. And it's interesting to think about why. What was so great about John? Why did Jesus say that? Now, some commentators, if you read the Bible and read some comments on it, some commentaries on it, some commentators think that what Jesus was talking about is John's position as a prophet. That John was kind of the transition from the Old Testament prophets like Elijah and Isaiah and Jeremiah, transitioning to the time of Jesus, and there's that old covenant and that new covenant, and John straddles that. He's kind of the Old Testament prophet, but transitioning us to Jesus. Some people think that what Jesus is talking about there is John's position. In other words, John's office. He was a prophet that was taking the world from the old covenant to the new, and it's this amazing transformation and all of the things that God is going to fulfill through Jesus. John is the one who is in position to tell us about that. So some people think that when Jesus says there's no one greater than John, they're talking about his position, his role, if you will. That could be. That could be. I don't think so. I think what Jesus is talking about is not John's position, but John's response to the position he finds himself in. I'm going to say that again. I think what made John great is not where he was, but how he responded to where he was. It was his response. If you look in the Old Testament, you'll see both David and Saul had the same position. They were both kings of Israel. Saul was the first king, David was the second king of Israel. They had the exact same position, yet they responded to it differently, and we see very different than responses from God to those two men. David was a man after God's own heart, and Saul was rejected by God, not because of their position, they had the same position, but because of their response. I think in the New Testament we see that too. Paul, the guy who wrote much of the New Testament, says something here in 1 Corinthians, when he's talking about his own position, kind of the position he finds himself in, and his response to it, in 1 Corinthians 4, 1 and 2, it says this, "So then, men ought to regard us," Paul's talking about himself and some of his contemporaries, "men ought to regard us as servants of Christ and as those entrusted with the secret things of God." So there's his position. I'm a servant of Christ. I've been given these secret things of God. But then he says this, "Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful." So there's a response to that. Paul recognizes this is where I find myself. Well, now I respond to that. I can go this way or I can go that way. He kind of fills that out a few chapters later in 1 Corinthians 9, verses 16 and 17. He says, this is Paul speaking again, "Yet when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, for I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. If I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I am simply discharging the trust committed to me." So I think what Paul is saying there is, yeah, like John the Baptist, Paul and we find ourselves in a circumstance. And God says, okay, this is where you are. This is your role here. How do we respond to it? I think that's what made John great. His response to where he found himself. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to look at that because I think that this passage that we're going to go through today helps us to understand what made John so great. Helps us to see how he responded to what was going on around him. And I think that's the key to understanding why Jesus said, of those born of women, There's none greater than John the Baptist. So I'm going to read this passage. It's only 9 verses. I'm going to read John chapter 3. I'm going to start with verse 22. I'm reading out of the NIV. You can follow along with me, but let me just read this. After this, Jesus and his disciples went out into the Judean countryside, where he spent some time with them and baptized. Now John also was baptizing at Anon near Salim, because there was plenty of water, and people were constantly coming to be baptized. This was before John was put into prison. An argument developed between some of John's disciples and a certain Jew over the matter of ceremonial washing. They came to John and said to him, "Rabbi, that man who was with you on the other side of the Jordan, the one you testified about, well, he is baptizing and everyone is going to him." To this John replied, "A man can receive only what is given him from heaven. You yourselves can testify that I said, 'I am not the Christ, but I am sent ahead of him.' The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine and is now complete. He must become greater. I must become less." All right. That's the passage we're going to look at. So let's just kind of walk through it here. And right away we see that John has been baptizing. This is what he's been doing. He's on the Jordan River, and people are coming to him to be baptized. And he's baptizing them for repentance. And he says to them, "I baptize you with water. There's one coming who's going to baptize you with fire." He's been baptizing people to help them get ready for when Jesus shows up on the scene. Well, now Jesus has showed up on the scene. Now Jesus is there. For a long time, John was operating solo. It was just him. Well, now Jesus has come. And here, at this point in the story, we see Jesus has been to Jerusalem and to Galilee and back and forth. He's come back to Jerusalem, and now he's gone out to the Jordan River, and His disciples are baptizing people. If you look at the next chapter, it says it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. But Jesus and those who are following him are on one side of the Jordan, and John is on the other side of the Jordan, and they're doing the same thing. John is baptizing people, like he's been doing for quite a while. Now Jesus is there doing the same thing. And it's interesting to me to think about that, because as far as I can tell, this was a one-time thing. I can't think of another time where it says that Jesus or his disciples baptized anybody. Jesus went on, he had a different ministry, a different mission than John had. And yet here, when John is still on the scene and John is doing what he's been doing, Jesus comes and does the exact same thing that John has been doing. And he doesn't ever do it any other time. Why is that, do you suppose? Why did Jesus go to where John was? He's just on the other side of the river. I'm sure he could see him. And he's doing the same thing that John has been doing. He's going to do it. He's going to baptize for a while, and then they're going to stop. He's going to stop and never do it again. Why? What's the point of that? Well, I don't know exactly, but I wonder if it's this. I'll offer this as a suggestion as to why Jesus was doing it. Perhaps Jesus was setting up what was going to happen next. He was setting himself side by side. He was operating in parallel with John. John has been doing wonderful work that God sent him to do, and now Jesus is coming and is paralleling John. He's doing the same work. He's doing it side by side within sight of each other. I wonder if Jesus did that on purpose. I'm going to go and I'm going to do the exact same thing that John has done. In essence, I'm going to stand side by side, and people are going to be able to see both of us at the same time. I wonder if he did that on purpose, specifically to set up what happens next. I don't know that, but I think maybe that's what was happening here. At least it would explain what happens next. So Jesus is baptizing, doing the same thing John has been doing, and people see them both doing it at the exact same time. So let's read the next couple of verses, verse 25. An argument developed between some of John's disciples and a certain Jew over the matter of ceremonial washing. They came to John and said to him, "Rabbi, that man who was with you on the other side of the Jordan, the one you testified about, well, he is baptizing and everyone is going to him." So John's disciples, these men who have been following John, helping him, serving him, learning from him, are still doing it. They're still with John, and it's interesting. It says they got into an argument about ceremonial washing. Ceremonial washing, this is something, it's referring to the Old Testament law. The Jews to whom John and Jesus were both going at this point, the Jews were following the Old Testament. They were excited about and dedicated to obeying the Old Testament laws. And so there are all kinds of laws in the Old Testament about when you wash and how you wash. A couple of weeks ago when we looked at the story of the wedding in Cana, you remember that? They were washing. They had the big stone jars there so that everybody could do the washing like they're supposed to. It was something that was in the law, and they were and it was something that the Jews did, and they were diligent about it. Well, John's disciples get into an argument with someone about ceremonial washing. And yet, when they come to John, what do they say? They don't say, John, tell us what you think about ceremonial washing. What do they say? Tell me, what do they say? Yeah. They say, John, you've become second. John, you used to be the big dog around here, and now you're not. Everybody who was coming to you, well, now they're going to him. And it shows really what was at the heart of their argument here. They were looking at John and comparing him to Jesus, and John was coming in second. Everybody's going to that guy. Everybody used to come to you, John. Everybody used to come to you. The Pharisees came to you and they asked you questions. And all the people came out to you and you were the man. You were the guy. And now he showed up and you're not the guy anymore. You are not the guy anymore, John. And there was jealousy and there was comparing. And John's disciples came to him and asked him to step into that with them. John, what's going on here? You have a ministry from God, John. You are a big man. You are an important man. God has given you power, John. His disciples, the people around him are saying, his handlers, his people are saying, God has given you power and you're losing it. And something has to happen. This isn't good. That's the implication here. If they thought this was a good thing, they'd say, isn't that great? Everyone's going, no, hey, what is going on here, John? And I think Jesus did this on purpose. I think Jesus did it on purpose. He stood himself next to John, and everybody went to Jesus, not John. The next few verses are John's response to this situation. He'd been the man. It's fading. The people around him are seeing it's fading. His star is declining and Jesus' star is rising. John's response to that is the next few verses. And it answers the question, what makes John so great? What's so great about John the Baptist? Well, I think it's his response. It's the next three verses. Shows us what's great about this guy. And I'm going to do this a little bit differently today. Normally, we'd walk through the verses and kind of work it through and come up with the answer, what makes John so great. I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to tell you the answer right now. And then we're going to go back to the verses and work through it. What makes John so great? Well, it's this. John knew his place, and he filled it faithfully and joyfully. John knew his place, and he filled it faithfully and joyfully. Now, when I say that, John knew his place, I'm curious how we react to that. Know your place. That sounds what? I mean, is that like a really great thing where you want to hear that a lot? Know your place. I don't. There's something in me that doesn't like that. When we say that we should know our place. I remember when I was a young Christian, just a young guy, I was excited about the Lord, and I was trying hard. We were down in Madison, little tiny church plant there. We were on fire for the Lord. We were, you know, a few college kids and a few older people, and we were going out on that campus. I think there were 60,000 students on campus, and there were, I think, 7 of us. And we would go out and we would preach the gospel. We'd go out on State Street on Friday night and preach the gospel, and we'd walk through campus and pass out tracts, and we'd go to the student unions and share the gospel. We were just on fire for the Lord, and I was running hard for God. I was leading a small group with our little church. I was leading worship. I was desperately falling in love with this young girl who was doing the same thing that I was doing, and I just felt like I had the world by the tail, and I knew my lane, and I was running with the Lord, and we're, you know, excited and young and full of energy and passion, and it was a great time. And I suddenly very strongly and severely got put in my place, and that young girl who I was falling in love with said to me, you're not a good man, and I don't want to be pursuing a relationship with you. And the guys who were leading the church came to me and said, you are not a good man. You need to stop leading a small group. We're not going to let you lead worship anymore. There were just things wrong with me. And I got put in my place. And that was one of the, at the time, it was the first crisis of my faith. It's like, holy smoke. What just happened? I got put in my place, and I did not like it. Because it wasn't fun. It was like, shut up and sit down, boy. Who wants to hear that? When we get put in our place, we don't like it for all kinds of reasons. One is because we lose control, don't we? If we get put in your place, We lose control. It's like somebody else doing something. I was running for the Lord, and I was pursuing this girl, and I was doing these things. I kind of was taking it and making it happen, and suddenly it was all taken away from me. Somebody else said, no, you can't do those things. I lost control. Well, that's not super fun. We don't like it because we feel then unimportant. At least I did. It's like, well, I thought I was doing these important things, but apparently not. Or apparently I'm not any good at them or something. And so I was relegated to a lower role, and then instantly we begin to compare ourselves. Well, if I'm put in my place, it means that somebody is above me. So when I say that John knew his place, if we really think about it, and kind of what's happening here, if you read it, one way to look at it is John is being put in his place. Jesus didn't have to come and baptize across the river from John. He didn't have to come do that. He never did it again. Could have gone anywhere else and done it. He did it right here, and John got put in his place. Jesus is better. People are going to him, not to me. I see the pecking order here, and I'm not at the top. I've been relegated to a lower position than what I had 6 months ago. John was put in his place. So how does he respond to that? See, we think of that as a bad thing. We think of that, even as I described it to you, and my situation in Madison and all that stuff, we think of that as a heavy-handed, harsh, painful thing. How did John respond to what just happened to him? Let's go back now and read the rest of that passage, verses 27 to 30, and see. How did John respond? Verse 27 and 28. To this John replied, "A man can receive only what is given him from heaven. You yourselves can testify that I said, I am not the Christ, but I am sent ahead of him." First thing John responded with this: he knew that his role was given to him by God. John knew that his role was given to him by God. He didn't create it himself. He didn't go out and grab it and make it happen. He didn't win it in a competition with all kinds of other people. It wasn't given to him by the leaders or anyone else. John was in the position he was in. His place, if you will, was given to him by God, and John knew it. John knew where I am, my role, my place is God-given. If you go back to John chapter 1, we've been through this, but in John 1, 6 through 9, we see all these things playing out. Again, talking about John chapter 1, verse 6, there came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He himself was not the light. He only came as a witness to the light. John was a witness. He knew that. I'm here as a witness to something else. There's the light, and that's Jesus, and I'm a witness to the light. He saw his place, and he saw that it was given by God. There came a man who was sent from God, and his name was John. And here was John's place. He was going to point to Jesus. John saw and felt God's hand in his place. He knew that his role was given to him by God. That's a powerful thing. This is what God has done. This was God's choice. This was God's plan, and he did it. I think John, all his life, his father knew that this was going to be John's place before John was even born. I think as John was growing up, Zechariah, his dad, was telling him, son, this is who you are. This is who God is going to make you. This is how God's going to use you. John didn't question that who he was sent from God. He saw and he felt God's hand in his life. His role was given to him by God. Verse 29. Says, the bride belongs to the bridegroom. This is John still speaking. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is not mine and is now complete. John recognized the goal of his work. He knew that his role had been given to him by God, and he recognized if he did his role, he knew what was going to happen. He recognized what success looked like. And success looked like exactly what was happening. People were going to leave him and go to Jesus. That's what success looked like. He knew what he was trying to make happen. And that helped him when it happened. Okay, good. Back in John chapter 1 again, in that passage, verse 7 of John chapter 1, it says, he, John, came as a witness to testify concerning that light so that through him all men might believe. He recognized, listen, men don't need me. John knew that his goal was to point people to someone that they really needed more than they needed John. Does that make sense? It's hard for us to believe that sometimes. No, what people really need is a little more of me, or at least a good portion of me. And they did. They did need John. John had a huge role, but it was a role in pointing people to somewhere else because that's who you really need. I love this picture. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is filled with joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. I've thought about that a lot. I've thought about that a lot. At a wedding, what is the focal point of all of the stuff that goes on? It's the bride and the groom. It's the bride and the groom, and it's that relationship, and it's them. When do people cheer the most? It's when they kiss, and I now pronounce you man and wife. That's the big thing. And that's the focal point. It's the bride and it's the groom and everything that's happened up to then, the photographer and the cake guy and the wedding, all everything else fades away to right there, because that's what you're there for. I've done lots of weddings as a pastor, and I have a role in seeing that young couple get married. I have a role. I'm the one that gets to say, by the power vested in me, the state of Wisconsin and the Lord Jesus Christ, I now pronounce you man and wife, and everybody cheers. And when I do a wedding, after all the pictures are done, they'll inevitably come and find me, and usually Sue, and we'll take a picture with the bride and the groom. Well, what would happen, how do you think it would go if I decided as the pastor proceeding over this wedding, I'm going to be in every picture? And so when the bride and groom are kissing for the first time, I'm and when they're cutting the cake, I got my hand there, you know. That would be weird and bad, and nobody wants to see that. And if I did that, I would be what? I would be out of place. I would be out of place. John's using that analogy. Listen, I'm here to get you two together. And now you're together. I'm going to step back. And I'm going to watch you two. That's what John is saying here. He recognized the goal of his work. And the goal was to introduce you to him. And then you two get together. That's a powerful thing. And John had seen that happen. He'd seen some of his best disciples leave already. Andrew, just a little while ago. Andrew, one of the he was one, I think, if I look at the, you know, the read the Gospels, Andrew seemed to be like one of those, you know, A1 recruits. He's the guy you want following you. And he was following John. And John said to Andrew, look, there's Jesus. He's the one I've been talking about. And Andrew left. He left John and he followed Jesus. And I think John said, good. Good. That was very good, because John knew he'd been sent by God and he knew what success looked like. The last verse here of John chapter 3, I'll read the end of verse 29, is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine and is now complete. He must become greater, I must become less. John was very content to elevate Jesus. He was very content. He found joy in that. Joy is one of those things we think of it as an emotion. Perhaps it's not. I don't think. It's a deep, abiding sense of satisfaction and contentment. The world is right. The world is right. And I am at peace in the world. John found that feeling, contentment and peace and satisfaction in lifting Jesus up. He must increase. And next to him, I must decrease. I am stepping back. Jesus came and did the same thing John did. And when they were compared, when Jesus and John were compared, John came in second best, and John knew it. And everybody around him knew it. And John found great joy in that, because that's who he was. That's who God made him. That's what God had sent him to do, and it was happening. And because John knew that, he found great joy in that. John knew his role. John knew his place. He filled it faithfully and joyfully. And I think that's what made him great. I think when Jesus said there's no one greater than John, I think, at least partly, that's what he was talking about. This man responded. And here's why that's so great. It's so great because that response is neither easy nor natural for us. That kind of response is hard for us because something in our sinful nature doesn't like any of that. I want to set my place. I don't want God or anyone else to tell me what my limits are. I don't want limits. I can do anything that I want to do. We love that in our culture. That's a we say that to ourselves. I watch, it's going to date me, I watch Bob Ross, The Joy of Painting, you know? Well, I watch the first 5 minutes and he puts me to sleep completely. But Bob Ross says that all the time. If you believe something, you can make it happen. And so then our limitations are just based on ourselves. Well, that's what our sinful nature wants to say. We can be as whatever we want to be. Well, knowing your place says, well, that's not true. That's not true. Somebody else is going to tell me. Somebody else is going to slot me. It's hard to accept that, I think. It's hard for our sinful nature to accept that. It requires to respond the way that John did. I think it shows a very, very deep understanding of who God is and a very, very deep and strong character. He had been shaped by God. John had a powerful understanding of who God was and who he, John, was in relation to God, and that relationship had shaped his character in some powerful, powerful ways. And I want to look at that a little bit here, because it's one thing to say, wow, that's great. It's kind of like, you know, who's the fastest man in the world these days? I don't even know. Or who's the, you know, who's the best basketball player? I've been watching the NBA. And so, you know, Victor Wembanyama, you know who he is? Crazy tall basketball player. He's like 90 feet tall, and he's just a freak. Everybody in his family played professional basketball, and you know, it's like you look at him and think, well, of course he's going to be a professional basketball player. I mean, of course he's going to be that way. If I was 80 feet tall and everybody played professional, I'd be that too. And somehow we think, yeah, but I'm not that, so I can't be that. I think it's important for us to look at what John did and recognize, you know what, this wasn't just because, okay, John can do that, but nobody else can. I don't believe that. I think if we look at why John responded the way he did, we can learn. We can become more like him. So what is it that made John respond the way he did? Well, I think that a response like that requires some things. It requires submission. If you're going to respond the way John did, you need to submit, and specifically, you need to submit to God's power, God's sovereignty. In Romans chapter 9, verses 20 and 21, it says, "But who are you, O man, to talk back to God? Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, 'Why did you make me like this?' Does not the potter have the right to make out of the same lump of clay some pottery for noble purposes and some for common use?" We need to submit to God's power. God made us. God made John. God made John for a specific role. I believe he makes you and I for specific roles. This verse in Ephesians 2:10, we read this a lot, or I do. I think about this verse a lot. Ephesians 2:10 says, "For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do." I like that verse because it gives me some, it makes me feel good about myself. Oh, I'm God's workmanship. There's a role for me. And that is good. It should do that. But it also says that that's God's choice. In other words, the role that I have, how I'm made, well, I didn't have anything to do with that. God did that. I am God's workmanship. He made me to do certain things. And if we're going to respond like John, we have to respond with submission to God's power. You made me, God. I did not make myself. And what I do in this world, where I am in this world, that has an awful lot to do with you. And my circumstance, my position, my gifts, my skills, my strengths, my weaknesses, my limitations, all of that, God, has been given to me by you. We must submit to the power of our Creator. I think John did. John understood, this is who I am because God made me this way. This is where I am because God put me here. This is what I'm doing because God put this in front of me. He submitted to the power of God. You must submit to God's power. But I think it also requires trust. It requires trust in God's goodness. Because if you think you got the short end of the stick, you might not want to just pursue this. You might not want to just work like John did. John was willing to take where God put him and then to be faithful with it, to work hard at it. He didn't just say, well, man, I don't want to do this. Well, he took it and he ran with it. And so it required trust in God's goodness. In 1 Corinthians 12, verse 7, it says, now to each one of us, the manifestation of the Spirit is given for the common good. In other words, each one of us has been given a place, a role, gifts, strengths for the common good. In other words, I fit here. You fit here. May not be what I would have chosen, but it's good. It's for the common good. The way God made me is very, very good. Later on in that chapter, verse 18, it says, but in fact, God has arranged the parts of the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. And later on, he says, on the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable, and the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty. While our presentable parts need no special treatment, but God has combined the members of the body and given greater honor to the parts that lacked it. We have to believe in God's goodness. We have to trust in God's goodness. Okay, I'm going to submit to his power. You made me this way. Okay, it's good. That's good, God. The way you didn't make a mistake, you didn't run out of parts, and I'm second best. I am your masterpiece. In Psalm 139, we use this verse when we talk about life and when it begins, or this passage, and it's good for that. But in Psalm 139:14, I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. God made me. God made you. And he made you, what does it say? Fearfully and wonderfully. You are wonderful. That's what it says. You are made by God, and it's wonderful. If I want to be like John, I got to trust that. I got to trust that. God, you made me. Your hand crafted me. You put me here. You have a role for me. I'm submitting to your power, and I am trusting in your goodness. It is very, very good where I am, how I am. And finally, if we want to respond like John, it requires patience for God's justice. Here's what I mean by that. It is so easy to work and feel like nothing's happening. To think, Lord, that person over there is seeing all kinds of great stuff happening, and I'm not seeing much. And we compare ourselves, and we look for proofs, if you will, that sometimes are not there or hard to find. That does not mean that God does not see and that God is not using what we do. It does mean that we need to be patient. In Galatians chapter 6, verse 9, this is a famous verse, and it's a good one for us to remember. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. God sees. God uses. He made us for good works. He put us in a place to do them. It's very good. He's going to use it. He's going to use you. Your place is good. We often don't see how good it is, many of us, until we leave this earth and go stand before God and he shows us. At the proper time, we will reap a harvest. I love this verse in Isaiah. I think about this a lot. This is a prophecy of the Christ, of Jesus himself, God himself, as a man. And it says this in Isaiah chapter 49, verse 4, but I said, I have labored to no purpose. I have spent my strength in vain and for nothing. Yet what is due me is in the Lord's hand. My reward is with my God. Do you realize when Jesus left this earth, he was abandoned and a failure, and he was executed? If you look at it from the earth's standpoint, if you look at it from the standpoint of what happened right now, at this exact moment, all of the people that were following him ran away. And the authorities caught him and killed him. And he's a pauper, and he's going to get buried in a borrowed grave, and it's all done. And it was a great experiment that just went nowhere. In that moment, from the world's standpoint, yeah. But not at all. Not at all. Because in the kingdom of heaven, he had done something amazing. And he said, what is due me is where? In the Lord's hand. My reward is with my God. People, listen. John the Baptist was the same way. Got thrown in jail, disappeared, got his head cut off. And then he's the greatest among those born of women. Here on earth? No. He was not here, but in heaven. We have to be patient in God's justice, in God's timing. John's response, I think, is what made him so great, or at least was a big part of it. He knew his role was given to him by God. He recognized the goal of his work, and he was content to elevate Jesus. He filled it faithfully and joyfully. That required submission to God's power. It required trust in God's goodness. It required patience for God's justice. Now, in the last couple of minutes, I want to say this. I think all of that was true of John. I think it can be true of you. I believe that can be true of you. You're not John. I'm not John. We are our own masterpiece. We are our own person that God created. But we can respond as John did. That's not reserved just for him. In Psalm 16, I told you about my time in Madison, that first crisis as a young Christian, where I was put in my place and I didn't like it. I did not like the place that I found myself in. And I was there because God was just like John. Jesus stood beside me and I was lacking. I had it all coming. I mean, but I learned my place. But in that point, when I was struggling, Lord, what do I do with this? I memorized Psalm 16. And these two verses in particular speak to this. Psalm 16, verses 5 and 6 says, Lord, you have assigned me my portion and my cup. You have made my lot secure. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. That encapsulates all the things that John responded. You, Lord, have assigned me my portion and my cup. Lord, you have assigned me, and you've made my lot secure. In other words, this is who I am, and nobody can take that away. You have made me. You have assigned me a place, and you can make it secure, Lord. I can submit to your power. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. I can't do everything I thought I wanted to do, but the things that you're asking me to do, they are pleasant. The boundaries are pleasant. The limits are pleasant. I can trust your goodness, God. And surely I have a delightful inheritance. Well, that's somewhere down the road. I can trust in your justice, Lord. I can trust that as I follow, you see and you use. And as I read that, and as a young Christian, 30 years ago, and as God spoke those words to me, well, as much as I could, I've set my foot on that path like John did. Lord, help me. I pray that I would understand, I would believe, and I would understand these things, and because I believe and understand them, they would shape the way I live. I want to respond to you, Lord, well. I want to be like John in this sense. I want to know clearly where you've put me, and I want to fill that role faithfully, and I want to find great joy in it. That's not a selfish prayer. I think that's God's desire for you and I. I think it is. God's desire for you and I. That we can see God's hand in our life. We can know our role. We can believe that that is good. And we can fill it faithfully and find great joy in the process. I believe that we can respond like John can. And I think not only is that a blessing to us and a great blessing to the world around us, it is an honor to God. That's not a selfish thing. That's an honoring thing to God. God, you made me. And I'm going to do what you're asking me to do. And I'm going to find joy in it. That's not selfish or grandiose. That is honoring to God. That is a blessing to the world around us. And that's how I want to live my life. And we can. Sometimes we can look at that and think, oh my gosh, John was like superhuman. I don't think he was. I think he's just like you and I. In a lot of ways. And I think you and I can have those things. We can respond that way. I like this verse in James chapter 1, verse 5. He's talking about character here. He's talking about understanding and character, verses 2, 3, and 4. It says, perseverance must finish at work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking in anything. And so he's talking, James is talking about becoming people like that. And then he says this in verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. I believe, folks, that if we are willing to go to God and say, Lord, show me my place. Help me to know the boundary lines. Help me to see them. Help me to trust that they're good. Help me to understand clearly who you've made me. Help me to know why, and then help me to walk in that, Lord. And God, give me joy as I do it. I believe you and I can have that. We can have that deep understanding of who God is and our relationship with him. We can have the deep character that John had. We can respond like John can to the benefit of the world around us, to the glory and honor of God, and to the joy of our own soul. I believe we can. If you ask God, come to him seriously. Here's the problem, folks. Here's the problem. We get so caught up with the world around us that we don't go to God and say, I want to know my place. I want to know it. I need to know it. I long to know. I must know who I am, and only you can tell me that. When I hear it, God, when I see it, give me the grace to walk it, to trust that it's good, to persevere in it to the end. That is a life well lived. That is a life well lived. You can have that life. I can. Is it because we're great, strong, mighty people who wrest it from the world and take what's ours? No. No. It's because we respond to our God. And we know who we are. And we know who he is. And we submit to his power. We trust in his goodness. We wait patiently for his justice. Do you know your role? Do you know who you are? Do you know who God has made you? Do you understand who you are before the Lord? Are you faithfully filling that role? Are you walking into it? Not perfectly. None of us does that. John didn't do that. Are you faithfully filling that role? And are you finding joy in that process? Humbly walking with your Father. Finding joy in seeing him do what he's going to do. Man, that's a good life, folks. That is a good life. I think if you asked John in heaven, he'd say, yeah. I'm sure he'd do things differently. But you know, Johnny got your head cut off and everybody left. Yeah. Wasn't it great? Because look at what God did. I knew who I was. I trusted my God. And there's joy in it. May that be true of us, of you and I. Lord, I pray that would be true of us. Thank you for the example of John. And we're not him. We're not John. We don't have the role he had. But we are your workmanship. We are created by you to do good works, which you prepared in advance for us to do. Help us to know them, Lord. Help us to trust. Help us to submit to your power, to know who you made us. Help us to trust your goodness, to choose to be content with who you made us. And help us, God, to wait patiently, to work to the end, no matter what we see now. Help us, Lord, to do those things. To your glory and honor, we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you for coming to Cedar Creek. Beautiful summer day. We'll see you next Sunday.